information when the consul had asked if this, then, was their promised transportation.
"They're showing off with the river," the consul had said softly. "It's used when the swarm is at rest, but for ceremonial purposes. Deploying it while the swarm is moving is for effect."
"To impress us with their superior technology?" asked Theo sotto voce. The consul nodded.
The river had wound and twisted through space, sometimes almost doubling back on itself in huge, illogical loops, sometimes wrapping itself in tight spirals like a fiberplastic cord, always gleaming in sunlight from Hyperion's star and receding to infinity ahead of them. At times the river occluded the sun, and the colors then were magnificent. Theo gasped as he looked at the river loop 100 meters above them and saw fish silhouetted against the solar disk. But always the bottom of the boat was down, and they hurtled along at what must have been near cislunar transfer speeds on a river unbroken by rocks or rapids. It was, as Arendez noted some minutes into their voyage, like driving one's canoe over the edge of an immense waterfall and trying to enjoy the ride on the way down. The river passed some of the elements of the swarm, which filled the sky like false stars, massive comet farms, their dusty surfaces broken by the geometries of hard vacuum crops, zero-g globe cities, great irregular spheres of transparent membrane, looking like improbable amoebae filled with busy flora and fauna. 10-click-long thrust clusters, accreted over centuries, their innermost modules and life cans and colleges looking like something stolen from O'Neill's boondoggle and the dawn of the space age. Wandering forests covering hundreds of kilometers like immense floating kelp beds, connected to their thrust clusters and command nodes by containment fields and tangled skeins of roots and runners. The spherical tree forms weaving to gravity breezes and burning bright green and deep orange and the 100 shades of old earth autumn when ignited by direct sunlight. Hollowed out asteroids, long since abandoned by their residents, now given over to automated manufacturing and heavy metal reprocessing. Every centimeter of surface rock covered by pre-rusted structures, chimneys, and skeletal cooling towers. The glow of their internal fusion fires making each cinderish world look like Vulcan's forge. Immense spherical docking globes, given scale only by the torch ship and cruiser-sized warcraft flitting around their surfaces like spermatozoa attacking an egg. And most indelible, organisms which the river came near or which flew near the river. Organisms which might have been manufactured or born, but probably were both. Great butterfly shapes, opening wings of energy to the sun. Insects which were spacecraft or vice versa. Their antennae turning toward the river and gondola and its passengers as they passed. Multifaceted eyes gleaming in starlight. Smaller winged shapes, humans, entering and exiting and opening in a belly the size of a force attack carrier's dropship bay. And finally had come the mountain. An entire range of mountains, actually. Some blistered with 100 environment bubbles, some open to space but still heavily populated. Some connected to others by suspension bridges 30 clicks long or tributary rivers. Others regal in their solitude, many as empty and formal as a Zen garden. Then the final mountain, rising higher than Mons Olympus or Asquith's Mount Hilary, and the river's penultimate plunge toward its summit. Theo and the consul and Arendez, pale and silent, gripping the thwarts with quiet intensity as they plunged the final few kilometers with a suddenly perceptible and terrifying velocity. Finally, in the impossible last 100 meters, as the river shed energy without deceleration, wider atmosphere surrounded them once again, and the boat floated to a halt in a grassy meadow where the Ouster Clan tribunal stood waiting, and stones rose in their circle of Stonehenge silence.
"If they did this to impress me," Theo had whispered as the boat bumped the grassy shore, "they succeeded."
"Why did you return to the swarm?" asked Freeman Genga. The woman paced, moving in the minuscule gravity with the grace common only to those born in space.
CEO Gladstone asked me to, said the consul.
And you came knowing that your own life would be forfeit.
The consul was too much the gentleman and diplomat to shrug, but his expression conveyed the same sentiment.
What does Gladstone want?
Asked another ouster. The man who had been introduced by Genga as spokesman of the eligible citizens Cordwell Minmun. The consul repeated the CEO's 5 points. Spokesman Minmun folded his arms and looked at Freeman Genga.
I will answer now, said Genga.
She looked at Arendez and Theo.
You two will listen carefully in the event that the man who brought these questions does not return to your ship with you.
Just a minute, said Theo, stepping forward to face the taller ouster. Before passing judgment here, you have to take into account the fact that—
Silence,
commanded spokesman Freeman Genga. But Theo had already been silenced by the consul's hand on his shoulder.
I will answer these questions now, repeated Genga.
Far above her, a score of the small warships which Force had called Lancers flashed silently past, darting like a school of fish in 300 G zigs and zags.
Firstly, said Genga, Gladstone asks why we are attacking the web.
She paused, looked at the other 16 ousters assembled there, and continued.
We are not, except for this swarm attempting to occupy Hyperion before the time tombs opened, there are no swarms attacking the web.
All three of the hegemony men had stepped forward. Even the consul had lost his veneer of bemused calm and was all but stuttering in excitement.
But that's not true. I saw the fatlined images from the—
Heaven's Gate is destroyed. God's Grove burned.
Silence,
commanded Freeman Genga. Into that silence, she said.
Only this swarm is doing battle with the hegemony. Our sister swarms are where the long-range web detectors had first placed them, moving away from the web, fleeing from further provocation such as Brescia's attacks.
The consul rubbed his face like a man awakening.
But then who?
Precisely, said Freeman Genga. Who would have the ability to carry out such a charade? And the motive to slaughter humans by the billion?
The core? Breathed the consul. The mountain was slowly rotating, and at this moment they turned into night. A convection breeze moved across the mountain terrace, rustling the ouster's robes and the consul's cape. Overhead, the stars seemed to explode into brilliance. The great rocks of the Stonehenge Circle seemed to glow from some internal warmth. Theo Lane stood next to the consul, fearing that the man might collapse.
We have only your word on this, Theo said to the ouster spokesman. It makes no sense.
Genga did not blink.
We will show you proof. Void which binds transmission locators. Real-time starfield images from our sister swarms.
Void which binds? Said Arendez.
His usually calm voice showed agitation.
What do you call the fat line?
Spokesman Freeman Genga paced to the nearest stone and ran her hand across its rough surface as if taking warmth from the heat within. Starfields pirouetted above.
To answer Gladstone's second question, she said, we do not know where the core resides. We have fled it and fought it and sought it and feared it for centuries, but we have not found it. You must tell us the answer to that question. We have declared war on this parasite entity you call the Technocore.
The consul seemed to sag.
We have no idea. Authorities in the web have sought the core since before the Hegira, but it is as elusive as El Dorado.
We found no hidden worlds, no massive asteroids crammed with hardware, and no hint of it on web worlds. He gestured tiredly with his left hand.
For all we know, you are hiding the core in one of your swarms.
We are not, said spokesman Cordwell Minmun.
The consul did shrug at last.
The Hegira bypassed thousands of worlds in the Grand Survey. Anything that didn't score at least 9.7 on their 10-point terabase scale was ignored. The core could be anywhere along those early lines of flight and exploration. We'll never find it, and if we do, it will be years after the web is destroyed. You are our last hope for locating it.
Genga shook her head.
Far above them, the summit caught the light of sunrise, while the Terminator moved down the ice fields toward them with almost alarming rapidity. Thirdly, Gladstone asked for our demands for a ceasefire. Except for this swarm in this system, we are not the ones attacking. We will accept a ceasefire as soon as Hyperion is under our control, which should be momentarily. We have just been informed that our expeditionary forces now have control of the capital and its spaceport.
The hell you say,
said Theo, hands curling into fists despite himself.
The hell we do say, agreed Freeman Genga. Tell Gladstone that we will now join you in a common fight against the Technocore.
She glanced toward the silent members of the tribunal.
Since we are many years' travel from the web, however, and we do not trust your core-controlled forecasters, our help must necessarily come in the form of retaliating for the destruction of your hegemony. You will be avenged.
That's reassuring, said the consul dryly.
Fourthly, Gladstone asks if we will meet with her. The answer is yes. If she is, as she says she is, willing to come to Hyperion system, we have preserved the Force Farcaster for just that eventuality. We will not travel by Farcaster.
Why not? Asked Arendes. A third ouster, not introduced, one of the furred and beautifully altered type, spoke.
The device you call a Farcaster is an abomination, a defilement of the void which binds.
Ah, religious reasons, said the consul, nodding in understanding. The exotically striped and furred ouster shook his head adamantly.
No, the Farcaster web is the yoke on humankind's neck, the contract of subservience which has bound you to stagnation. We will have none of it.
Fifthly, said Freeman Genga, Gladstone's mention of a death wand explosive device is nothing but a crude ultimatum, but as we have said, it is aimed at the wrong opponent. The forces sweeping into your frail and failing web are not of the clans of the 12 sister swarms.
We have only your word on that, said the consul. His gaze, now locked with Genga's, was firm and defiant.
You have my word on nothing, said spokesman Genga. Clan elders do not give their word to core slaves, but this is the truth.
The consul seemed distracted as he half turned toward Theo. We have to get this word to Gladstone immediately. He turned back to Genga. May my friends return to the ship to communicate your response, spokesman. Genga nodded and gestured for the gondola to be made ready.
We're not going back without you,
Theo said to the consul, stepping between him and the closest ousters, as if to protect the older man with his own body.
Yes,
said the consul, touching Theo's upper arm again.
You are. You must.
He's right, said Arendez, pulling Theo away before the young governor-general can speak again. This is too important to risk not communicating. You go, I'll stay with him.
Genga gestured toward two of the more massive exotic ousters.
You will both return to the ship. The consul will remain. The tribunal has not yet decided his fate.
Arendez and Theo both wheeled with fists raised, but the furred ouster seized them and moved them away with the restrained effort of adults handling small but unruly children. The consul watched them set in place in the gondola, and he stifled the urge to wave as the boat moved 20 meters down the placid stream, dipped out of sight beyond the curve of the terrace, and then reappeared climbing the waterfall toward black space. It was lost to sight within minutes in the glare of the sun. He turned slowly in a full circle, making eye contact with each of the 17 ousters.
Let's get it over with, said the consul. I've waited a long time for this.
Saul Weintraub sat between the great paws of the Sphinx and watched the storm abate, wind dying from scream to sigh to whisper, curtains of dust diminishing and then parting to show the stars, and finally the long night settling into a dreadful calm. The tombs glowed more brightly than before, but nothing came out of the blazing doorway of the Sphinx, and Saul could not enter. The push of blinding light was like 1,000 irresistible fingers against his chest,
and lean and strain as he might, Saul could get no closer than 3 meters from the doorway. Whatever stood or moved or waited inside was lost to sight in the glare of light. Saul sat and held on to the stone stair as time tides pulled at him, tugged at him, and made him weep in the false shock of déjà vu. The entire Sphinx seemed to rock and pitch in the violent storm of expanding and contracting anti-entropic fields.
Rachel.
Saul would not leave while there was any chance his daughter might be alive. Lying on cold stone, listening to the wind scream die, Saul saw the cold stars appear, saw the meteor trail and laser lance thrust and counter thrust of orbital war, knew in his heart that the war was lost, that the web was in danger, that great empires were falling as he watched. The human race might be hanging in the balance this endless night, and he did not care. Saul Weintraub cared about his daughter. And even as he lay there, cold, buffeted by winds and time tides, bruised with fatigue and hollow from hunger, Saul felt a certain peace descend on him. He had given his daughter to a monster, but not because God had commanded him to, not because fate or fear had willed it, but only because his daughter had appeared to him in a dream and told him that it was all right, that this was the thing to do, that their love, his and Sarai's and Rachel's, demanded it.
In the end, thought Saul, past logic and hope, it is dreams and the love of those dearest to us that form Abraham's answer to God.
Saul's comm log no longer worked. It might have been an hour or 5 hours since he had handed his dying infant to the shrike. Saul lay back, still gripping stone as the time tides made the Sphinx bob like a small ship on a big sea, and stared at the stars and battle above. Sparks drifted across the sky, glowed bright as supernovae, as laser lances found them, and then fell in a shower of molten debris, white-hot to red to blue flame to darkness. Saul imagined dropships burning, imagined ouster troops and hegemony marines dying in a scream of atmosphere and melting titanium. He tried to imagine this, and failed. Saul realized that space battles and the movements of fleets and the fall of empires were beyond his imagining, hidden from the reservoirs of his sympathy or understanding. Such things belonged to Thucydides and Tacitus and Catan and Wu. Saul had met his senator from Barnard's world, had met with her several times in his and Sarai's quest to save Rachel from Merlin's sickness. But Saul could not imagine Feldstein's participation on the scale of interstellar war, or in anything much larger than dedicating a new medical center in the capital of Bussard, or pressing the flesh during a rally at the university in Crawford. Saul had never met the current hegemony CEO, but as a scholar he had enjoyed her subtle replay of the speeches of such classical figures as Churchill and Lincoln and Alvarez Temp. But now, lying between the paws of a great stone beast and weeping for his daughter, Saul could not imagine what was in that woman's mind as she made decisions that would save or damn billions, preserve or betray the greatest empire in human history. Saul didn't give a damn. He wanted his daughter back. He wanted Rachel to be alive despite all logic to the contrary. Lying between the Sphinx's stone paws on a besieged world in a ravaged empire, Saul Weintraub wiped tears from his eyes, the better to see the stars, and thought of Yeats's poem, A Prayer for My Daughter. Once more the storm is howling, and half hid under this cradle hood and coverlid my child sleeps on. There is no obstacle but Gregory's wood and one bare hill, whereby the haystack and roof-leveling wind, bred on the Atlantic, can be stayed. And for an hour I have walked and prayed, because of the great gloom that is in my mind. I have walked and prayed for this young child an hour, and heard the sea-wind scream upon the tower, and under the arches of the bridge, and scream in the elms above the flooded stream, imagining in excited reverie that the future years had come,
dancing to a frenzied drum out of the murderous innocence of the sea. All Saul wanted, he realized now, was the same possibility once again to worry about those future years which every parent fears and dreads, to not allow her childhood and teenage years and awkward young adulthood to be stolen and destroyed by the sickness. Saul had spent his life willing the return of things unreturnable. He remembered the day he had come upon Sarai, folding Rachel's toddler clothes and setting them in a box in the attic. And he recalled her tears and his own sense of loss for the child they still had, but who was lost to them through the simple arrow of time. Saul knew now that little could be returned except by memory, that Sarai was dead and beyond ability to return, that Rachel's childhood friends and world were gone forever, that even the society he had left only a few weeks of his time ago was in the process of being lost beyond return. And thinking of that, lying between the taloned paws of the Sphinx as the wind died and the false stars burned, Saul is reminded of part of a different and far more ominous poem by Yeats. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in the sands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again. But now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born. Saul does not know. Saul discovers again that he does not care. Saul wants his daughter back. The consensus in the War Council seemed to be to drop the bomb. Mayna Gladstone sat at the head of the long table and felt the peculiar and not unpleasant sense of separateness which comes from far too little sleep over far too long a period. To close her eyes, even for a second, meant sliding on the black ice of fatigue, so she did not close her eyes. Even when they burned and when the drone of briefings, conversation, and urgent debate faded and receded through thick curtains of exhaustion. Together the council had watched as the embers of Task Force 181.2, Commander Lee's attack group, had winked out one by one until only a dozen of the original 74 were left still driving toward the center of the approaching swarm. Lee's cruiser was among the survivors. During this silent attrition, this abstract and oddly attractive representation of violent and all too real death, Admiral Singh and General Morpurgo had completed their gloomy assessment of the war.
Force and the new Bushido were designed for limited conflicts, minor skirmishes, proscribed limits and modest aims, summarized Morpurgo. With less than 500,000 men and women under arms, Force would not be comparable to the armies of one of the old Earth nation-states 1,000 years ago. The swarm can swamp us with sheer numbers, outgun our fleets and win through arithmetic.
Senator Kolchev glowered from his place at the opposite end of the table. The Lusian had been much more active in the briefing and debate than Gladstone. Questions were turned his way more frequently than to her, almost as if everyone in the room were subliminally aware that power was shifting, the torch of leadership was being passed. Not yet, thought Gladstone, tapping her chin with steepled fingers and listening to Kolchev cross-examine the general.
Of falling back and defending essential worlds on the second wave list. Tau Ceti Center, of course, but also necessary industrial worlds, such as Renaissance Minor, Fuji, Deneb Vir, and Lucis.
General Morpurgo looked down and shuffled papers as if to hide the sudden flash of anger in his eyes.
Senator, less than 10 standard days remain until the second wave completes its target list. Renaissance Minor will fall under attack within 90 hours. What I am saying is that with the current size, structure, and technology available to Force, it would be doubtful if we could hold one system, say TC squared.
Senator Kaki Numa rose.
"This is not acceptable, General."
Morpurgo looked up.
"I agree, Senator, but it is true."
President Pro Tem Denzel Hyatt Amin sat shaking his gray and mottled head.
"It makes no sense. Were there no plans to defend the web?"
Admiral Singh spoke from his seat.
"The best estimates of the threat told us that we would have a minimum of 18 months should the swarms ever turn toward the attack."
Minister of Diplomacy Persov cleared his throat.
"And if we were to concede these 25 worlds to the ousters, Admiral, how long until the first or second wave could attack other web worlds?"
Singh did not have to refer to his notes or comm log.
"Depending on their target, M. Persov, the nearest web world, Esperance, would be 9 standard months away from the closest swarm. The most distant target, home system, would be some 14 years by Hawking Drive."
"Time enough to shift to a war economy," said Senator Feldstein.
Her constituency on Barnard's world had less than 40 standard hours to live. Feldstein had vowed to be with them when the end came. Her voice was precise and passionless.
"It makes sense. Cut your losses. Even with TC squared and 24 more worlds lost, the web can produce incredible quantities of war materiel, even in 9 months. Within the years it will take for the ousters to penetrate farther into the web, we should be able to beat them through sheer industrial mass."
Defense Minister Emoto shook his head.
"There are irreplaceable raw materials being lost in this first and second wave. The disruption to web economy will be staggering."
"Do we have a choice?" asked Senator Peters from Deneb Dre. All eyes turned toward the person sitting next to AI Counselor Albedo. As if to underline the importance of the moment, a new AI persona had been admitted to the War Council and had given the presentation on the awkwardly labeled Death Wand device. Counselor Nansen was tall, male, tanned, relaxed, impressive, convincing, trustworthy, and imbued with that rare charisma of leadership that made one both like and respect the person on sight. Mayna Gladstone feared and loathed the new counselor at once. She felt as if this projection had been designed by AI experts to create just the response of trust and obedience she sensed others at the table already granting. And Nansen's message, she feared, meant death. The Death Wand had been web technology for centuries, designed by the Corps and limited to force personnel and a few specialized security forces, such as government houses and Gladstone's Praetorians. It did not burn, blast, shoot, slag, or incinerate. It made no sound and projected no visible ray or sonic footprint. It simply made the target die. If the target were human, that is. A Death Wand's range was limited, no more than 50 meters. But within that range, a targeted human died, while other animals and property were totally safe. Autopsies showed scrambled synapses, but no other damage. Death Wands merely made one cease to be. Force officers had carried them as short-range personal weapons and symbols of authority for generations. Now, Counselor Nansen revealed, the Corps had perfected a device that utilized the Death Wand principle on a larger scale. They had hesitated to reveal its existence, but with the imminent and terrible threat of the ouster invasion. The questioning had been energetic and sometimes cynical, with the military more skeptical than the politicians. Yes, the Death Wand device could rid us of ousters, but what about the hegemony population? Remove them to shelter on one of the labyrinthine worlds, Nansen had replied, repeating the earlier plan of Counselor Albedo. 5 kilometers of rock would shield them from any effects of the widening Death Wand ripples. How far do these death rays propagate? Their effect diminished to below the lethal level at just under 3 light-years, Nansen responded calmly, confidently, the ultimate salesman in the penultimate sales pitch. A wide enough radius to rid any system of the attacking swarm. Small enough to protect all but the nearest neighboring star systems. 92% of the web worlds had no other inhabited world within 5 light-years. And what about those who can't be evacuated? Morpurgo had demanded. Counselor Nansen had smiled and opened his palm as if to show there was nothing hidden there. Do not activate the device until your authorities are sure that all hegemony citizens are evacuated or shielded, he had said.
It will be, after all, totally under your control. Feldstein, Sabin Storafem, Peters, Persoff, and many of the others had been instantly enthusiastic. A secret weapon to end all secret weapons. The ousters could be warned. A demonstration could be arranged. "I'm sorry," Counselor Nansen had said. His teeth, when he smiled, were as pearly white as his robes. "There can be no demonstration. The weapon works just as a death wand, only across a much wider region. There will be no property damage or blast effect, no measurable shock wave above the neutrino level, merely dead invaders." To demonstrate it, Counselor Albedo had explained, "You must use it on at least one ouster swarm." The excitement of the War Council had not been lessened. "Perfect," said All Things Speaker Gibbons. "Choose one swarm, test the device, fatline the results to the other swarms, and give them a 1-hour deadline to break off their attacks. We didn't provoke this war. Better millions of the enemy dead than a war that claims tens of billions over the next decade." "Hiroshima," Gladstone had said, her only comment of the day. It had been said too softly for anyone except her aide Sedeptra to hear. Morpurgo had asked, "Do we know that the killing rays will become ineffective at 3 light-years? Have you tested it?" Counselor Nansen smiled. If he answered yes, there were heaps of dead humans somewhere. If he said no, the device's reliability was seriously at stake. "We are certain that it will work," said Nansen. "Our simulation runs were foolproof." The Kiev team AI said that about the first Farcaster singularity, thought Gladstone, the one that destroyed Earth. She said nothing aloud. Still, Singh and Morpurgo and Van Zeit and their specialists had spiked Nansen's guns by showing that Mare Infinitus could not be evacuated quickly enough, and that the only first-wave web world that had its own labyrinth was Armagast, which was within a light-year of Pachem and Svoboda. Counselor Nansen's earnest, helpful smile did not fade.
"You want a demonstration, and that would be only sensible," he said quietly. "You need to show the ousters that invasion will not be tolerated, while focusing on the minimum loss of life. And you need to shelter your indigenous hegemony population."
He paused, folded his hands on the tabletop.
"What about Hyperion?"
The buzz around the table deepened in tone.
"It's not really a web world," said Speaker Gibbons.
"Yet it is in the web now, with the Force Farcaster still in place," cried Garion Persoff of Diplomacy, obviously a convert to the idea.
General Morpurgo's stern expression did not shift.
"That will be there only another few hours. We're protecting the Singularity Sphere now, but it could fall at any time. Much of Hyperion itself is already in ouster hands."
"But hegemony personnel have been evacuated?" said Persoff.
Singh answered. "All but the Governor General. He could not be found in the confusion."
"A pity," said Minister Persoff without much conviction. "But the point is that the remaining population is mostly Hyperion indigene, with easy access to the labyrinth there, correct?"
Barbary Dan Giddes of the Ministry of Economy, whose son had been a fiberplastic plantation manager near Port Romance, said,
"Within 3 hours, impossible."
Nansen stood.
"I think not," he said. "We can fatline the warning to the remaining Home Rule authorities in the capital, and they can begin the evacuation immediately. There are thousands of entrances to the labyrinth on Hyperion."
"The capital of Keats is under siege," growled Morpurgo. "The entire planet is under attack."
Counselor Nansen nodded sadly.
"And soon we'll be put to the sword by the barbarian ousters. A difficult choice, gentlemen and ladies. But the device will work. The invasion will simply cease to exist in Hyperion space. Millions might be saved on the planet, and the effect on the ouster invasion forces elsewhere would be significant. We know that their so-called sister swarms communicate by fatline. The termination of the first swarm to invade hegemony space, the Hyperion swarm, may be the perfect deterrent."
Nansen shook his head again, and looked around with an expression of almost paternal concern. There could be no simulating such pained sincerity.
"It has to be your decision. The weapon is yours to use or disregard. It pains the Corps to take any human life, or through inaction allow any human life to come to harm.
But in this case, where the lives of billions are at risk. Nansen opened his hands again, shook his head a final time, and sat back, obviously leaving the decision to human minds and hearts. Babble around the long table rose. Debate grew almost violent.
CEO, called General Morpurgo.
In the sudden silence, Gladstone lifted her gaze to the holographic displays in the darkness above them. The Mare Infinitus swarm fell toward that ocean world like a torrent of blood aimed toward a small blue sphere. Only three of the orange Task Force 181.2 embers remained, and even as the silent council watched, two of these winked out. Then the final one was extinguished. Gladstone whispered into her comlog.
Communications. Any last message from Admiral Lee?
None to the command center, CEO, came the response. Only standard fatline telemetry during the battle. It appears they did not reach the center of the swarm.
Gladstone and Lee had held hopes of capturing ousters, of interrogations, of establishing the identity of their enemy beyond a doubt. Now that young man of such energy and ability was dead. Dead at Mayna Gladstone's command. And 74 ships of the line were wasted.
Mare Infinitus Farcaster destroyed by preset plasma explosives, reported Admiral Singh. Forward elements of the swarm now entering cislunar defense perimeter.
No one spoke. The holographics showed the tidal wave of blood-red lights engulfing the Mare Infinitus system, the final orange embers around that gold world blinking out. A few hundred of the ouster ships remained in orbit, presumably reducing Mare Infinitus's elegant floating cities and ocean farms to burning debris. But the major part of the blood tide rolled on, out of the region projected above.
Asquith system in 3 standard hours, 41 minutes,
intoned a technician near the display board. Senator Kolchev stood.
Let's put the Hyperion demonstration to a vote, he said,
ostensibly addressing Gladstone but speaking to the crowd. Mayna Gladstone tapped her lower lip.
No, she said at last. No vote. We will use the device. Admiral, prepare the torch ship armed with the device to translate to Hyperion space and then broadcast warnings to planet and ouster alike. Give them 3 hours. Minister Emoto, send coded fatline signals to Hyperion, telling them that they must, repeat, must, seek shelter in the labyrinths at once. Tell them that a new weapon is being tested.
Morpurgo wiped sweat from his face.
CEO, we can't run any risk that this device can fall into enemy hands.
Gladstone looked at Counselor Nansen and tried to make her expression reveal nothing of what she felt. Counselor, can this device be rigged so that it detonates automatically if our ship is captured or destroyed?
Yes, CEO.
Do it. Explain all necessary failsafe devices to the proper force experts. She turned toward Sedeptra. Prepare a web-wide broadcast for me, scheduled to commence 10 minutes before the device is to be detonated. I have to tell our people about this.
Is that wise? Began Senator Feldstein.
It is necessary, said Gladstone. She rose, and the 38 people in the room rose a second later. I'm going to get a few minutes' sleep while you people work. I want the device ready and in system and Hyperion warned immediately. I want contingency plans and priorities for a negotiated settlement ready by the time I awaken in 30 minutes. Gladstone looked out at the group, knowing that one way or the other, most of the people there would be out of power and out of office within the next 20 hours. One way or another, it was her last day as CEO. Mayna Gladstone smiled. Council dismissed, she said, and Farcast to her private quarters to take a nap. 43. Lee Hunt had never seen anyone die before. The last day and night he spent with Keats, Hunt still thought of him as Joseph Severn, but was sure that the dying man now thought of himself as John Keats, were the most difficult in Hunt's life. The hemorrhages came frequently during Keats's last day of life, and between these bouts of retching, Hunt could hear the phlegm boiling in the small man's throat and chest as he fought for life. Hunt sat next to the bed in the small front room in the Piazza di Spagna and listened to Keats babble as sunrise moved to mid-morning and mid-morning faded to early afternoon. Keats was feverish and moving in and out of consciousness, but he insisted that Hunt listen and write everything down. They had found ink, pen, and foolscap in the other room, and Hunt complied, scribbling furiously as the dying Cybrid raved on about metaspheres and lost divinities, the responsibilities of poets and the passing of gods, and the Miltonic civil war in the core. Hunt had perked up then and squeezed Keats's feverish hand.
"Where is the core, Sev? Keats, where is it?"
The dying man had broken into a visible sweat and turned his face away.
"Don't breathe on me, it comes like ice."
"The core,"
repeated Hunt, leaning back, feeling close to tears from pity and frustration.
"Where is the core?"
Keats smiled, his head moving back and forth in pain. The effort he made to breathe sounded like wind through a ruptured bellows.
"Like spiders in the web,"
he muttered.
"Spiders in the web, weaving, letting us weave it for them, then trussing us and draining us, like flies caught by spiders in the web."
Hunt quit writing as he listened to more of this seemingly senseless babble. Then he understood.
"My God," he whispered, "they're in the Farcaster system."
Keats tried to sit up, grasped Hunt's arm with a terrible strength.
"Tell your leader, Hunt. Have Gladstone rip it out, rip it out. Spiders in the web. Man-God and machine-God must find the union, not me."
He dropped back on the pillows and started weeping without sound.
"Not me."
Keats slept some through the long afternoon, although Hunt knew that it was something closer to death than sleep. The slightest sound would start the dying poet awake and set him wrestling to breathe. By sunset, Keats was too weak to expectorate, and Hunt had to help him lower his head over the basin to allow gravity to clear his mouth and throat of bloody mucus. Several times, when Keats fell into fitful naps, Hunt walked to the window and once down the stairs to the front door to stare into the piazza. Something tall and sharp-edged stood in the deepest shadows opposite the piazza, near the base of the steps. In the evening, Hunt himself dozed off while sitting upright in the hard chair next to Keats's bed. He awoke from a dream of falling and put his hand out to steady himself, only to find Keats awake and staring at him.
"Did you ever see anyone die?"
asked Keats, between soft gasps for breath.
"No."
Hunt thought that there was something odd about the young man's gaze, as if Keats were looking at him but seeing someone else.
"Well, then, I pity you," said Keats. "What trouble and danger you have got into for me. Now you must be firm, for it will not last long."
Hunt was struck, not only by the gentle courage in that remark, but by the sudden shift in Keats's dialect from flat web-standard English to something much older and more interesting.
"Nonsense," said Hunt heartily,
forcing enthusiasm and energy he did not feel.
"We'll be out of this before dawn. I'm going to sneak out as soon as it gets dark and find a Farcaster portal."
Keats shook his head.
"The shrike will take you. It will allow no one to help me. Its role is to see that I must escape myself, through myself."
He closed his eyes as his breathing grew more ragged.
"I don't understand," said Leigh Hunt,
taking the young man's hand. He assumed this was more of the fever talking. But since it was one of the few times Keats had been fully conscious in the past 2 days, Hunt felt it worth the effort to communicate.
What do you mean, escape yourself through yourself?
Keats's eyes fluttered open. They were hazel and far too bright.
Umon and the others are trying to make me escape myself through accepting the godhood hunt. Bait to catch the white whale. Honey to catch the ultimate fly. Fleeing empathy shall find its home in me. In me, Mr. John Keats, 5 feet high. And then the reconciliation begins. Right?
What reconciliation?
Hunt leaned closer, trying not to breathe on him.
Keats appeared to have shrunk in his bedclothes, tangle of blankets, but heat radiating from him seemed to fill the room. His face was a pale oval in the dying light. Hunt was only faintly aware of a gold band of reflected sunlight moving across the wall just below where it met the ceiling. But Keats's eyes never left that last smear of day.
The reconciliation of man and machine, creator and created, said Keats, and began to cough, stopping only after he had drooled red phlegm into the basin Hunt held for him. He lay back, gasped a moment, and added, reconciliation of humankind and those races it tried to exterminate, the core and the humanity it tried to expunge, the painfully evolved god of the void which binds, and its ancestors who tried to expunge it.
Hunt shook his head and quit writing.
I don't understand. You can become this messiah by leaving your deathbed?
The pale oval of Keats's face moved back and forth on the pillow in a motion which might have been a substitute for laughter.
We all could have, Hunt. Humankind's folly and greatest pride. We accept our pain. We make way for our children. That earned us the right to become the god we dreamed of.
Hunt looked down and found his own fist clenched in frustration.
If you can do this, become this power, then do it. Get us out of here.
Keats closed his eyes again.
Can't. I'm not the one who comes, but the one who comes before. Not the baptized, but the Baptist. Meerdunt. I'm an atheist. Even Severn couldn't convince me of these things when I was drowning in death.
Keats gripped Hunt's shirt with a fierceness that frightened the older man.
Write this.
And Hunt fumbled to find the ancient pen and rough paper, scribbling furiously to catch the words Keats now whispered.
A wondrous lesson in thy silent face. Knowledge enormous makes a god of me. Names, deeds, grey legends, dire events, rebellions, majesties, sovereign voices, agonies, creations and destroyings all at once pour into the wide hollows of my brain and deify me as if some blithe wine or bright elixir peerless I had drunk, and so become immortal.
Keats lived for 3 more painful hours, a swimmer rising occasionally from his sea of agony to take a breath or whisper some urgent nonsense. Once, long after dark, he pulled at Hunt's sleeve and whispered sensibly enough,
"When I am dead, the shrike will not harm you. It waits for me. There may not be a way home, but it will not harm you while you search."
And again, just as Hunt was bending over to hear if the breath still gurgled in the poet's lungs, Keats began to talk, and continued between spasms,
until he had given Hunt specific instructions for his entombment in Rome's Protestant cemetery, near the pyramid of Caius Cestius.
"Nonsense, nonsense,"
Hunt muttered over and over like a mantra, squeezing the young man's hot hand.
"Flowers,"
whispered Keats a little later, just after Hunt had lighted a lamp on the bureau. The poet's eyes were wide as he stared at the ceiling in a look of pure childish wonder. Hunt glanced upward and saw the faded yellow roses painted in blue squares on the ceiling.
"Flowers. Above me," whispered Keats, between his efforts to breathe.
Hunt was standing at the window, staring out at the shadows beyond the Spanish steps, when the painful rasp of breath behind him faltered and stopped, and Keats gasped out,
"Severn! Lift me up! I am dying!"
Hunt sat on the bed and held him. Heat flowed from the small body that seemed to weigh nothing, as if the actual substance of the man had been burned away.
"Don't be frightened. Be firm. And thank God it has come,"
gasped Keats. And then the terrible rasping subsided. Hunt helped Keats lie back more comfortably as his breathing eased into a more normal rhythm. Hunt changed the water in the basin, moistened the fresh cloth, and came back to find Keats dead. Later, just after the sun rose, Hunt lifted the small body, wrapped in fresh linens from Hunt's own bed, and went out into the city. The storm had abated by the time Braun Lamia reached the end of the valley. As she passed the cave tombs, she had seen the same eerie glow the other tombs were emitting, but there also came a terrible noise, as if of thousands of souls crying out, echoing and moaning from the earth. Braun hurried on. The sky was clear by the time she stood in front of the Shrike Palace. The structure was aptly named. The half-dome arched up and outward like the creature's carapace, support elements curved downward like blades, stabbing the valley floor, and other buttresses leaped upward and away like shrike thorns. Walls had become translucent as the interior glow increased, and now the building shone like a giant jack-o'-lantern shaved paper-thin. The upper regions glowed red as the shrike's gaze. Braun took a breath and touched her abdomen. She was pregnant. She had known it before she left Lucis. And didn't she owe more now to her unborn son or daughter than to the obscene old poet on the Shrike's tree? Braun knew that the answer was yes, and that it did not matter one damn bit. She let out the breath and approached the Shrike Palace. From the outside, the Shrike Palace was no more than 20 meters across. Before, when they had entered, Braun and the other pilgrims had seen the interior as a single open space, empty except for the blade-like supports that crisscrossed the space under the glowing dome. Now, as Braun stood at the entrance, the interior was a space larger than the valley itself. A dozen tiers of white stone rose rank on rank and stretched into the faded distance. On each tier of stone, human bodies lay, each garbed a different way, each tethered by the same sort of semi-organic, semi-parasitic shunt socket and cable which her friends had told Braun she herself had worn. Only these metallic but translucent umbilicals pulsed red and expanded and contracted regularly, as if blood were being recycled through the sleeping form's skulls. Braun staggered back, affected by the pull of anti-entropic tides as much as by the view. But when she stood 10 meters from the palace, the exterior was the same size as always. She did not pretend to understand how cliques of interior could fit into such a modest shell. The time tombs were opening. This one could coexist in different times for all she knew. What she did understand was that when she was awakening from her own travels under the shunt,
She had seen the Shrike's thorn tree tied with tubes and vines of energy, invisible to the eye, but now quite obviously connected with the Shrike palace. She stepped to the entrance again. The Shrike waited inside. Its carapace, usually gleaming, now seemed black, silhouetted against the light and marble glare around it. Braun felt the adrenaline rush fill her, felt the impulse to turn and run, and stepped inside. The entrance all but vanished behind her, remaining visible only by a faint fuzziness in the uniform glow which emanated from the walls. The Shrike did not move. Its red eyes gleamed from the shadow of its skull. Braun stepped forward, her booted heels making no sound on the stone floor. The Shrike was 10 meters to her right, where the stone biers began, ascending like obscene display racks to a ceiling lost in the glow. She had no illusion that she could make it back to the door before the creature closed on her. It did not move. The air smelled of ozone and something sickly sweet. Braun moved along the wall at her back and scanned the rows of bodies for a familiar sleeping face. With each step to her left, she moved farther from the exit and made it easier for the Shrike to cut her off. The creature stood there like a black sculpture in an ocean of light. The tears did stretch for kilometers. Stone steps, each almost a meter high, broke the horizontal lines of dark bodies. Several minutes' walk from the entrance, Braun climbed the lower third of one of these stairways, touched the nearest body on the second tier, and was relieved to find the flesh warm, the man's chest rising and falling. It was not Martin Silenus. Braun continued onward, half expecting to find Paul Duray or Saul Weintraub or even herself lying among the living dead. Instead, she found a face she had last seen carved into a mountainside. Sad King Billy lay motionless on white stone, 5 tiers up, his royal robes scorched and stained. The sad face was, as were all the others, contorted in some internal agony. Martin Silenus lay 3 bodies away on a lower tier. Braun crouched next to the poet, glancing over her shoulder at the black speck of the Shrike, still unmoving at the end of the rows of bodies. Like the others, Silenus appeared to be alive in silent agony, and was attached by a shunt socket connected to a pulsating umbilical which, in turn, ran into the white wall behind the ledge as if wed to the stone. Braun panted from fear as she ran her hand over the poet's skull, feeling the fusion of plastic and bone, and then felt along the umbilical itself, finding no join or opening to the point where it melded with stone. Fluid pulsed beneath her fingers. "Shit," whispered Braun, and in a sudden flurry of panic looked behind her, certain the Shrike had crept within striking distance. The dark form still stood at the end of the long room. Her pockets were empty. She had neither weapon nor tool. She had realized that she would have to return to the Sphinx, find the packs, dig out something to cut with, and then return and muster enough courage to enter here again. Braun knew that she could never come through that door again. She knelt, took a deep breath, and brought her hand and arm up, then down. The edge of her palm smashed against material that looked like clear plastic and felt harder than steel. Her arm ached from wrist to shoulder from the single blow. Braun Lamia glanced to her right. The Shrike was moving toward her, stepping slowly like an old man out for a leisurely walk. Braun shouted, knelt, and struck again, palm edge rigid, thumb locked at right angles. The long room echoed to the impact. Braun Lamia had grown up on Lucis at 1.3 standard gravity, and she was athletic for her race. Since she was 9 years old, she had dreamed of and worked toward becoming a detective. And a part of that admittedly obsessive and totally illogical preparation had been training in the martial arts. Now she grunted, raised her arm, and struck again, willing her palm to be an axe blade, seeing in her mind the severing blow, the successful strike through. The tough umbilical dented imperceptibly, pulsed like a living thing, and seemed to cringe away as she swung again. Footsteps became audible below and behind her. Braun almost giggled. The Shrike could move without walking, go from here to there without the effort of going between. It must enjoy scaring its prey. Brawn was not frightened. She was too busy. She raised her hand, brought it down again. It would have been easier striking the stone for effect. She slammed her palm edge into the umbilical again, feeling some small bone give in her hand.